Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, authors Charisse Burden-Stelly and Andrew W. Carl discuss their work in writing Black history with journalist Ariane Nettles. This program originally took place May 19th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Good afternoon and welcome to our next program here at the American Writers Festival. This one in conjunction with our most recent exhibit titled Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice. So this website can now be seen on our website, AmericanWritersMuseum.org. And teachers, please note, we have a high school curriculum designed around this exhibit as well. The scholars and writers who we now invite upon our stage look at the ways in which Black history is tied up with American capitalism and how racism and economic injustice intersect and reinforce one another. Dr. Charisse Burden-Stelly is an associate professor of African American Studies at Wayne State University and is a 2023-2024 Charles Warren Center visiting scholar at Harvard University. She's the author of Black Scare, Red Scare, Theorizing Capitalist Racism in the United States. Andrew W. Carl is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Virginia. He is the author of the books The Land Was Ours and Free the Beaches. They'll be interviewed today by Ariane Nettles, author of We Are the Culture, Black Chicago's Influence on Everything. Welcome to you all.
Thank you all so much for being here. I am just really excited to be in conversation with these amazing scholars. And just to just kind of set the tone for today, I'm not sure how many of you in the audience have had a chance to read these amazing books by Drs. Carl and Burden-Stelly just yet. And so my goal today is to not only introduce you to their works, but also kind of give you a really good primer on what their scholarship means for us today, okay? And so to start off, I have a question. This is not a trick question. It might sound like a trick question, but it is not, okay? I promise you. So my question is really, who would you say your book is for? So for example, I would say like, oh, my book is for anybody that loves Chicago, right? So just who would you say that your book is for? Because I think we got a lot of people in this audience that are hoping to grab it. And so what are the things that you think would kind of attract those people? Dr. Burden-Stelly, would you like to kick us off?
This is a really interesting question, but also welcome everyone. Thank you for being here. But you know, I always say, I never have an audience in mind when I write a book. Usually I'm just working out a series of problems or queries or provocations, and then I move on to the next thing. But I will say the audience for this book was graduate school me. It's the book that I wanted for graduate school, a combination of history, political theory, and engaging the Black radical tradition. I think a book that was really a history of the present, something that dealt with racial oppression and capitalist exploitation, and that gave a good sense of sort of how we got to where we are, that kind of exploded traditional historical categories. So it's interesting that this is a Black history panel. I always say, like, I'm not a historian. I'm trained in Black studies, but I'm historically nosy. So
that's perfect. Yes. I have a question for that, too. don't worry.
Yeah, that gives me a little bit more latitude. So, like, there's kind of traditional historical periodizations that I don't feel beholden to because I'm an interdisciplinary scholar. So, the audience is graduate school me, but I think it's a book that will appeal to persons who are in academia, but also organizers and activists who I also had in mind writing this book, so that folks who are engaging in struggle around economic democracy, racial justice, et cetera, can have some historical grounding in terms of where we are, but also be aware of the forms of repression that also obtain. We see this happening now across U.S. colleges and universities as these encampments are sprouting up and being dismantled, but also that this struggle is not new. It's something that's been happening for a very long time, and despite the extraordinary odds, people continue and will continue to engage in this work. So,
thank you, Dr. Carl.
Yeah, so my book, and thank you all for coming out this afternoon. I'm really excited to get a chance to talk about my new book, The Black Tax. And, you know, this is a book that is for everyone who pays taxes, who utilizes public services, and who is concerned about inequality in America and want to understand the engines that are reproducing inequality. So, everyone. And in that sense, I think, you know, this is a book that really sort of looks at and asks the question, like, what can we learn about the structure of American society and the forces that have been reproducing inequality by looking at how public dollars are raised and spent, and how tax systems operate at the local level in particular. And so that was really the kind of question that I went into in doing this research and looking at how local tax systems work, how they've affected struggles for racial justice in housing, in schools, and in public life. And also how they can help us begin to understand some of these more vexing questions about, you know, how housing markets don't work for Black Americans in the same way they work for white Americans. What have been the causes, specific causes of the massive amount of land lost over the course of the 20th century by African Americans? And as well, why do we continue to see the persistence of segregation and inequality in public education? Why are Black neighborhoods continuing to be, suffer from disinvestment and public neglect and continue to be exposed to higher rates of, you know, environmental and public health challenges? In many respects, all of these tie back to the ways in which we structure and spend public dollars. And so that's kind of, in some ways, something that really affects all of us. It's kind of, not to belabor the obvious, but, you know, there's a reason why they say, you know, there are only two sure things in life are death and taxes. So, yeah. You know, this is a story about one of those. So
don't we know it, right? And I love those answers, because I think that both of these books, right, are really great for curious folks who are interested in solving, like, these big problems. And what to me ties both of these books together in a really interesting way is that they both aim to dispel certain myths. So, for example, Dr. Carl, your book dispels the myth that Black Americans don't pay taxes and that we don't deserve certain services and things, because it's like, oh, no, we've been overburdened by taxes. We pay more than our fair share of taxes, right? And so it dispels this really big myth that affects how our country runs and how people view certain systems and policies. And Dr. Bernastelli, your book really dispels the myth of what you call, like, this true Americanism, this idea that, and I would love for you to define it, because I feel like you can do a better job of me, but, like, just to kind of briefly intro it, this idea that nothing, America is made of all these great things, but those great things are not, like, Black. They're not communist. They're not these things. And so I would love for both of you to kind of talk about dispelling myths that contribute to problems as you talk about them.
Sure. I mean, this is kind of foundational to this book as a whole. It proceeds from what I, early on in the process of sort of working on this subject, was really struck by just the vast gulf between the public narratives around public spending and taxation in American history, the myths and vicious lies that have been sort of told and serve particular political ends to perpetuate myths about, who pays taxes and then, therefore, who deserves the public's public dollars, and when it comes to the distribution of public dollars. And so that was something, when I began to see just, this pervasive overtaxation of African-American neighborhoods, of the property and homes that African-Americans have owned, one that spanned from the 19th century all the way up to the present, one that was transcended both the South and the North, and how that is really was something that I thought just needed to be tackled head on. And we needed to not just sort of challenge that myth, but actually look at the mechanics of local taxation and understand what was actually really going on here, so that ultimately we can have a more informed conversation about what type of system we want to have and how we can actually get there and dismantle some of these forces that continue to perpetuate inequality through tax systems. And again, this is a history of a problem that very much remains unresolved. None of the sort of things that I bring to the attention of readers throughout this history, both the systemic overtaxation of black neighborhoods and homes, the continued sort of maldistribution of public dollars and the underserving of African American communities, as well as the heightened exposure of black property owners to dispossession and exploitation via our tax delinquency laws. All these are continuing to this day. And so, in a sense, like, this is a history that really is aimed to not just sort of explode these myths, but actually sort of peek under the hood and see what's really going on.
Thank you. Yeah.
There's at least five myths, I think, that my book dispels. So one has to do with this idea that Marxism or communism is like white people stuff or European stuff, that it has no relevance to black people or African folks. And part of what I convey is that there was a very strong current of anti-capitalist thought and organizing among black people. And this is precisely what made them even more seen as sort of even more dangerous by the US state. Another is that capitalism is this sort of objective system of the exchange of goods and services in the marketplace. But in fact, capitalism is a system that's predicated on imperialism, super exploitation, inequality, and endless accumulation for a very tiny minority of the population. A third myth is that it's a dual myth. One is that the US is not imperialist because it has no formal colonies. Of course, we'd have to disregard Puerto Rico and Hawaii and many other things. But also that imperialism is something that happens out there. Part of what I convey with the term Wall Street imperialism is my book is that there's an internal logic to Wall Street imperialism, part of which is borne out by the relationship between the US North and the US South, especially in my period under study. To the point, for example, where Southerners would call investment from northern banks and corporations foreign direct investment, right? A fourth myth is that radicalism is foreign inspired. It's something that comes from out there, whether it's by, so there's this idea was articulated through Germans during World War I, then Bolsheviks, which is sort of the focus of my book, Bolsheviks during World War II, or a so-called outside agitators, a discourse that we're hearing about now, who came from the North to rile up the otherwise docile and satisfied black folks in the South. So there's this perpetual idea that radicalism or discontent with one's exploitation is exogenous, right? That black people have to be riled up by something else. And so part of what I convey is that that's a state discourse to discredit any struggle that challenges the status quo. And then I think a fifth myth is one that you talked about, that the US is the most democratic, equal, and opportunity-laden place on the earth, right? And sometimes this falls along what's called like a but-for logic, that the U.S. will be the greatest place on earth but for racism. Well, there is no U.S. society without histories of indigenous genocide, of enslavement, of what's called the afterlives of enslavement, etc. So there is no without racism, right? At least not in the foreseeable future. And then there's another myth that's related to this, is this linear progress narrative, that as we move through time, things get better, more equal, and more just. And time, especially when it comes to justice, there is no like arc of justice. That's another mythology, or maybe even something one can hope for, but that's something that hasn't borne out, especially if we look at Black people and political dissidents, that it in fact has sort of been, it's been much more messy than that, so.
Yeah, so many important things to unpack, but one thing I would love to go back to is that idea of capitalism, because I do think that we use that a lot more common in today's conversation, and a lot of us may or may not even know what we're, you know, I think some of us do, right? But I think that I would love for you to expand a little bit more on that idea of what capitalism is compared to maybe what we, some of us think it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that capitalism has become, and concomitantly, right, socialism became more mainstream. Capitalism as an object of critique, I'll say, became more mainstream through like Occupy. And this is where we got this concept of the 99%. So that was a sort of a way to bring a critique of capitalism into the mainstream. It had always been there, of course, on the margins, but Occupy 2011, I think, made it more mainstream. And so I think that what we're commonly taught in economics courses, right, economics is how people choose to use scarce resources to satisfy their unlimited wants. I learned that definition in seventh grade of economics, right, that it's all about personal choice, competition in the marketplace, that there's this invisible hand of the market that makes everything equal and rational. And so if you're poor or dispossessed or exploited, it's your own individual or moral failing. Or it's something, it's just a sort of natural order of things, and sorry about that, right? And those who have wealth and resources worked hard, they earned them fairly and justly, they deserve them, and then also they deserve to rule, right? They deserve to be in power. People, there's a equivalence between money and fittedness to rule, and then the other side to that is poverty and ill-fittedness for anything but like further dispossession. So I think, you know, and then this idea of like entrepreneurship. So, you know, businesses are the engine of society. And if everybody, you know, has this entrepreneurial spirit and this work ethic, then that is the basis of a equal or at least equality of opportunity. My understanding of capitalism is not that, right? a more orthodox, like Marxist understanding is that there are two classes, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. Proletariat are folks who have to sell their labor for wages. The bourgeoisie own the means of production, factories, for example, news media, etc. And that these two classes are fundamentally antagonistic, and that the driver of history is this class struggle. So there are aspects of the orthodox Marxist perspective that I share, but I also think that there's a racial and colonial logic to it. That's a Leninist position, I suppose. Anyway, so basically, I guess the moral of the story, to make a short story long, as I'll do this whole afternoon, is that capitalism is a system that's fundamentally built on inequality, and it's not individual or moral failings that lead to this inequality. It is the way that the system is set up so that a small group of folks can hoard the majority of resources to the detriment of other people, and that this is not natural, right? This is not something that always has been and always will be. This is by design, which means that other economic systems have been the way of the world before, and so other economic systems can exist later.
Yeah, I mean, picking up on that, I think, you know, we know that, you know, capitalism produces inequality, and African Americans have disproportionately borne the impact of that inequality. And we also have a sense here of, like, how, you know, it stands to reason that, you know, the U.S. tax system would be one that sort of helps to facilitate and reinforce those inequalities. But oftentimes, we often put, like, the state in one category and the market in another. And I think one of the things that my book really shows and really looks at a long history of the way that, in particular, when it comes to property taxation, not just the sort of policies, but also the sort of administrative practices surrounding it, have, you know, really served as an instrument of capital accumulation accumulation in housing markets. And that's, housing markets have been, and it's been well established, structurally racist in ways that, actually sort of not just, sort of don't have equal benefits, but actually exacerbate inequality in a whole host of measures. And so one of the things that I look at in particular, and I think one area where you can begin to see sort of how, local tax laws, function as a force of capital accumulation through dispossession is by looking at the way that tax delinquency laws work and how they have sort of functioned to not just, compound disadvantage, but actually to sort of spawn this highly profitable predatory marketplace that makes money off of investing in distressed homeowners investing in the debts of distressed homeowners, and through that be accumulating profit and property, and how the state is not just sort of abiding by this, but is actually orchestrating it. I mean, here in Chicago, Cook County holds tax auctions in which investors come in, Wall Street investors, hedge funds, private equity are diving headfirst and have been for generations diving into this tax delinquency marketplace because of the ways in which it offers opportunities to extract value from low-income and disproportionately black and brown neighborhoods. And this, again, is sort of one indication of how, and again, it's conducted here by, through local government, and how that's happening across the country in ways that have quietly but over time had long-term devastating effects both on African Americans' ability to secure home ownership and to sort of build wealth through home ownership, and as well have sort of been one of many sort of forms of economic predation that characterizes the ways in which capitalism has functioned and functioned against African-American economic mobility.
Yes, no, I'm so glad that you brought that up and added that, because that's kind of, so often home ownership is used as an example of the pull yourself up idea, that individualized, like, you are responsible, you need to buy a home, and that is how you create wealth for your family. And so many of us here in Chicago, like you mentioned, like, I want to say maybe last year, really recently even understood how you can own or you can owe tax and have tax debt, and that debt go into an auction and you lose your home, not because of your mortgage payments, but because of your tax debt, right? And how in Chicago, such a large percentage of those people who are losing homes due to tax debt at the auction are black. And so much of that we don't know, even as homeowners.
There's another book that actually is really very much in conversation with your book, Kianga Yamada Taylor's mm-hmm. book, Race for Profit.
Yeah. Is that? Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Yes, Race for Profit, but also where she talks about the concept of predatory inclusion, mm-hmm. right? So it's including black people into the American dream, but under mm-hmm. extraordinarily exploitative terms. And then there's also a book by Destin Jenkins called mm-hmm. Bonds of Inequality that's about the bond markets and how that was a sort of a white democratic project to build or offer up public space and land for white folks in California. He's looking at San Francisco.
Of course, and it's Wall Street sort of, structuring exactly. the terms on public finance in mm-hmm. ways that, sort of help explain why these inequalities yeah. sort of pervade across American cities today. And I mean, that was something that was, kind of really sort of drove me to work on this book, was a sense of frustration. It's less so now as a result of books like Kianga Taylor's. Mm-hmm. But, when I first began working on this, I was frustrated by this sort of sense that was being perpetuated. There was a lot of real interest in the history of redlining, of course, in the history of housing inequality. But oftentimes it operated, or at least there was an implicit assumption here that the problem that African Americans faced was one of exclusion, exclusion from these supposedly universal opportunities that were just out there waiting for them if they could grab a hold of them. But that didn't explain to me the fact that, as where my story begins, in the late 19th and early 20th century, African Americans had 16 million acres of land in the U.S. They had property, and that property became it generated wealth over the course of the 20th century, but it was wealth for other people. It was wealth through, acquired through dispossession. And so, you know, that in a sense sort of, you know, led me to question, like, you know, is exclusion the problem here, or is it actually the sort of way in which the system is structured as a whole that ensures that any time property falls, you know, African Americans are able to acquire homes or, you know, build up a land base, it's going to be, it's not going to generate wealth in the same way it does for white homeowners, and it's going to be much more vulnerable to loss. And in that sense, again, local tax systems are not the sole explanation of this, but they're a key piece of the puzzle in understanding how this you know, works as a whole.
Yeah. And so thank you both for that, because I know that I can't speak for everybody else here, but it is very rare that I get to ask you all these types of questions that I have scholars and experts on some of this stuff. And so I am learning a lot. And Dr. Carl, as a follow-up to that, you know, a lot of times when we think about taxes, we think about federal taxes. You know, we're thinking about, oh man, like, have y'all seen the tax rate? Like, I make more, I get taxed more, like all of these things. It's a struggle. I feel like I'm, you know, struggling to keep up. But so many of us don't maybe pay attention to those local tax systems. And so your book really talks about how, of course, these local tax systems and processes are overlooked. And can you maybe explain, like, why they're overlooked compared to maybe the federal taxes?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, my book is a book on taxes, but the IRS is nowhere to be found. This is really a book that's focused, and I'll also say, again, for those of you who might be sort of dissuaded from reading a book about taxes, is, you know, there, it is remarkably free of charts, graphs. It is a human-centered story. It actually is centered around people, and it's centered around places, and it actually sort of actually humanizes these processes. Maybe that's one of the ways, you know, local taxes are actually sort of, you know, lend themselves to being able to really see where the money goes. You know, being able to follow the money in terms of sort of where it's extracted, you know, where it's taken from, where it's devoted to, and then how it's enforced. And so I think one thing just to establish off the bat is, you know, local taxes matter a great deal. Not only do they constitute over one-fifth of all public revenue raised in this country, and in the past, you know, where my story begins, it was much higher before the 1930s with, you know, the vast expansion of the federal state, but also as well, I mean, this is what funds public education in America. This is the streets you walk, you know, drive down, the sidewalks you walk on, the water you drink, you know, this sort of, you know, where you flush your toilet. I mean, all these things are actually sort of a product of sort of local public spending policies and priorities. And so that's, in a sense, like, you know, you can really see the materiality of public spending and tax systems when you look at it at the local level. And I think one of the other things I really try to stress, because my book is very much focused on property taxes, because those are the lifeblood of local government finance. I mean, that is constitutes a chief revenue source of local taxes, of local governments in America, is that one of the things I sort of point out is, like, it's, you know, property taxes are not inherently a bad tax. In fact, it is the only wealth tax we have in this country. But the thing that I really sort of pinpoint and sort of try to focus in on is the local nature of these, and what a local tax system that is locally administered is virtually unaccountable to the federal government. I mean, you have, you know, you as a local taxpayer have very few recourse when you are the victim of discriminatory practices at the local level. And also just the fact that it is locally raised and locally spent, all those features of it actually work to sort of reproduce inequality at, like, say, at the metro scale. Again, think about, you know, why do some suburbs have, you know, large tax bases that they can spend, you know, sort of ample amounts of resources on their constituents, and others are struggling to keep the lights on and the water clean and the streets paved. Like, all those go back to this kind of the way that we structure public spending in America, and how that can help us begin to understand, like, you know, why do we see this sort of persistence of segregation and inequality, not just in the neighborhoods where we live, the schools where our children go. I mean, all these things kind of tie back to the fiscal incentives that this system puts in place. And also, again, how do we explain why you continue to see these sort of forms of favoritism that are intentional or just structural, that are built into the way, you know, how much people pay in property taxes? You can't understand that unless you understand that this is a local tax. And I think that's something I try to really sort of get us to sort of focus on throughout the book.
Thank you. Dr. Bernastelli, the first paragraph of your book kind of knocks me out a little bit, and I just want to say, I just want to read a quote that you have in that first thing. So for me, it was very thought-provoking. And it is when someone says, so I'll let you explain the context around that. Why in God's name do we want to control the earth, right? So we were just talking about imperialism and this idea, that myth that the U.S. is not an imperialist nation when we know it to be. So can you talk a little bit about that quote and your decision to kind of center that as the start, this explosive start to your book?
Yeah, so that's a quote from W.E.B. Du Bois. He was testifying before the House Committee on Foreign Relations in 1949 against increase in military spending. And so part of what he's, that quote goes on to say, you know, we want to rule the world, and we try, basically he says, like, one example that he gives, he says, you know, we try to rule Puerto Rico, we gave them the highest suicide rate in the world. You know, we want to rule a world full of colored people when the U.S. hates, quote, chinks and niggers, right? Basically, you know, they want to impose Southern racial rule on the world, and that this is, like, this is unattainable. One of the most important things that he says in his statement is about witch words, and this is something that appears throughout the text. And so he says, we invent witch words. During the time of slavery, the word was abolitionist. If one was against the system of slavery, he was a scoundrel, a, quote, nigger lover, and was somebody who should be basically lynched. And he said the word today is communist. Anybody who believes basically in economic democracy is a scoundrel. He's somebody who is prone to lose his job or get thrown in jail simply for believing in economic democracy. And so this witch words is really important because it's how we label things in order to discredit them. And so right now we see that happening in our current moment with anti-Semitism and the conflation of anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism or not being very precise or historically specific with what that means, up to and including the U.S. House of Representatives passing an act that conflates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism when many Jewish folks themselves have said the two are not the same. And so anti-Semitism becomes a witch word insofar as labeling anything anti-Semitic completely shuts down the conversation. It completely shuts down your ability to organize, to speak freely. So it imposes limitations on freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of association, freedom of the press, due process. And this is something that develops from or follows from communist having that exact same effect. So for example, civil rights being labeled communist or, you know, so to discredit a very real, very important struggle in which African Americans, but many other groups of Americans were engaged. And so Du Bois is a really important figure throughout the text because of, you know, he lived almost 100 years, but also because he is somebody that represents a central figure who organized for economic democracy and racial democracy and also against imperialism. And so it was important to open the book in that way because it frames a lot of the questions that I take up later on.
Thank you. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Du Bois is in my book as well. He's in every, you know, any sort of history of America, you know, from 1865 through 1963, mm-hmm. It's going to have to include Du Bois. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, again, speaking about, you know, about how, you know, the sort of challenges of trying to sort of actually, you know, sort of, you know, speak the truth on these matters without, you know, being attacked or sort of disparaged. This was a sort of continuous sort of struggle that African Americans were facing, especially as I described, this sort of Jim Crow fiscal order was being built. One that, again, sort of denied the actual direct public contributions that African Americans were paying as a way to both justify and rationalize the gross underspending on public goods and services for African Americans, none more prominent than schools, and as well the overtaxation of the neighborhoods and homes and land that African Americans owned. And Du Bois and many others throughout this generation are continually trying to sort of produce the facts, to actually show the receipts that in fact, like throughout southern states during the era of segregation, African Americans were contributing more in direct tax dollars to public school systems, far more than they were getting back in return, as a way to sort of counter these sort of myths that were aimed to sort of justify this vastly unequal system. And yet we continue to see this to this day. I mean, you know, again, in more subtle and insidious ways, how these sort of myths, again, that you know, it's kind of foundational to the modern right, you know, Reagan's welfare queen, all the way up through Mitt Romney's infamous 47%, were, you know, kind of variations on this theme about, you know, the notion that some people sort of contribute more and therefore are more deserving of the rights and privileges of citizenship or of the civic rights that we have sort of allocated to local governments when it comes to sort of distribution of these vital public goods and needs. And I think that's, again, one of these areas where sort of, you know, the sort of frustration of past generations and challenging these notions and actually demanding their fair share is a theme that kind of continually runs throughout across this history.
Got it. I do want to ask you both a question about craft a little bit, right? Because both of these books tackle these huge ideas, right? And then multiple really big ideas inside these huge ideas, right? And, you know, Dr. Carl, your book spans about 150 years. We're going from Reconstruction to the 21st century. Dr. Burton Stelly, your book is a little bit more concise in the time, you know, going from World War I around 1917 through the Cold War in the 1940s, but you're going deep, right? And so both of these require a lot of context, right? Because I would say that both of these books are books that you can read if you are not experts on this subject. I say that because I don't know about y'all, but I am not an expert in either of these subjects, and I'm able to read these books, right? So how did you both balance that, right? How did you balance being able to say, this is the story I am telling, but I gotta make sure that my audience has the context that they need in order to understand these really big concepts that I'm laying out?
Well, you know, editors do actually a lot of work on that end. So you write like multiple drafts a thing. And so editors actually, sometimes in a problematic way, sometimes in a helpful way, sort of help to shape the narrative in a way that they deem accessible. But I think that for me, being in conversation with activists and organizers as I was writing the multiple drafts of the book about, you know, what are the themes that seemed most important, what was unclear, what were in fact the sort of holes in knowledge, as well as you have book workshops. A book workshop is a relatively new thing where you have experts or scholars come in and they read a draft of the manuscript and they give you feedback, and again, give feedback on form, organization, it's not like grammar and stuff, but like form, organization, content, and accessibility, all these types of things. But I think that you really can only go like broad or deep. It's very difficult to do both in like 250 or 300 pages, right? Unless you're writing like a huge like Crisis of the Negro Intellectual size book, which is like 600 pages. It's really difficult to do. And so I think that for me, telling a broad story, like a more sort of working at a particular level of abstraction, was more important than telling a very sort of localized or small story, which is also important just because I was trying to show striking continuity, right? That these things, as they say, like history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And so as you look in these different historical moments that are often treated as sort of discrete closed containers, actually, when you look at things like repression, anti-black racial oppression, and its entanglement with anti-radicalism, there's actually these striking continuities. And so when we think about the Red Scare, for example, most people just think about McCarthyism. But it's really in the 1930s with the Fish Committee. There's like the Fish Committee and the Dyes Committee that actually turned into the House Committee on Un-American Activity. So that's one of the foundations of what comes to be known as McCarthyism. In the 1920s, there was the Lusk Committee, which is a New York State level committee. And so a lot of the things that we attribute to one historical moment actually have much longer roots, even dating back to like the Espionage Act of 1917 and the Sedition Act of 1918, which then gets sort of transferred in peacetime to the Smith Act, the Alien Registration Act of 1940. So all of that to say, I think that for me, I wanted to tell a big story, like give a broad swath and then leave it to sort of other authors or the footnote, you know, citing things in the footnotes to fill in some of the more close-up detail.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think back on it often in the sense that, like, when I began sort of looking at this question about, you know, racial discrimination and inequity within you know, local taxation, I had no roadmap. Like, nobody had really written on this subject. I, like, struggled to find secondary source material, you know, talking about the inequities within, you know, how local taxes are administered and how they're enforced. And also, more broadly, you know, even amongst, you know, people who write on housing and race, and who've written about, you know, sort of or urban historians, which you know, sort of, you know, a lot of the work I draw on, you know, taxes had always kind of been on the periphery, maybe gestured to or referenced, but never really, you know, put at the center of analysis. And similarly, when it comes to the sort of literature on taxes and tax policy, whether it be local or federal, you'll see race sort of woven in, but you'll never see it from the perspective of Black people. Like, there's never, you know, no one has ever really asked, like, what did it mean to be an African American paying taxes within this system? Like, how did African Americans experience this, and how did, you know, what did this look like from their vantage point? And so that was something that I really, you know, wanted, you know, became the kind of ways in which I sort of structured the whole, that, you know, tried to sort of, you know, put as the kind of, you know, the goals of this book as a whole, is to begin to really move these issues from the periphery to the center, and also to sort of go beyond policy and to actually look at administration, like not just to sort of take policies at their face, but actually understand, like, because I think in many respects, like how policies are administered and enforced really reveals how power operates in society. And I think you can really learn a lot just through looking at the administrative process. And so I was very especially attentive to the ways in which, you know, these gray areas of local tax administration that could be exploited or abused. And I think kind of getting back to the kind of question of how did I make this accessible, I mean, this was a big challenge because local taxes are just absolutely mystifying. I mean, they're really, I mean, and especially the big greater challenge for me as well was how do I write a national history of this inherently local practice that varies wildly from state to state, from locale to locale. You know, the laws on, you know, on tax delinquency are different in Illinois than they are in Wisconsin, than they are in Indiana. The way in which properties are assessed, oh my God, I mean, it just is, you know, in some places it's, you know, they assess it in one manner and another. So one of the goals that I had was really, how do I sort of get at what's really happening here? How can I sort of make broader observations, explain what the audience needs to know in a way that they can understand? Not in the way that it was written in these sort of economics articles or law journal articles in highly specialized, often opaque language that was kind of, in many ways, I saw as designed to sort of scare away sort of the audiences that actually really need to understand this. Like, so I took the exact opposite approach. Like, let's actually explain what's really going on here in a way that can actually, you know, be readily understood by any audience, and especially those who have never, you know, looked at or studied tax policies or administration before. And so that was kind of like my goal all along, was like thinking, like, all right, how can this, you know, can anyone pick this book up who's never looked at these matters, who's never, you know, actually even really looked closely at their tax bill, and be able to understand, like, how this was operating?
I appreciate that. I snuck that in for myself, actually. So it was a little selfish. But we have time for one more question. And so I just want to ask you both, what do you want readers to take away? Like, when they finish this book, when they close that cover, what do you want them to take away from it?
Well, I think a couple things. One is about sort of communism. you don't have to be a communist if you're struggling for racial justice or a socialist. But part of what I try to convey is you cannot be an anti-communist, because anti-communism and anti-black racial oppression are so tightly bound up that you are sort of cutting off some of the most able organizers, some of the best thinkers, some of the most strategic positions if you are an anti-communist. And that ultimately, if you're black, it doesn't matter how closely you hew to the state line, you are because you are challenging a racial capitalist society, like, it's still, you will still be seen as, you know, other at best. And so, for example, I give the example of Marcus Garvey, who was no communist, right? In fact, he was a vehement anti-communist, especially after 1921, but he was still red baited. He was still attacked as Bolshevik adjacent, right? He was deported in 1927. But another takeaway is that is the importance of organizing. Like, organizing is really important, and it's also what sort of sustained these individuals and collectives against state repression. That joining an organization, belonging to an organization, is really important. We're in a time where there's a lot of hostility toward organizing, for some good reasons, some not. But that is the only way to build a mass base. That is the only way to challenge an entity like the state that has more power, more resources, and a monopoly on violence. And so, those are two, I think, important takeaways from Black Skin, Red Skin.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think, we are living in vastly unequal times. And, we are in a situation right now, and especially when it comes to matters of, the sort of public. And I think, we have grossly sort of underinvested and massively need to reinvest in a whole host of sort of measures. And I think this is a book that really aims to kind of help us begin to understand how we got here. And I think, just as I think, African-American history is found foundational to understanding American history. I think, you cannot really understand the history of American capitalism or the history of the American state without looking at it through the perspective and through the experiences of African Americans. And so this is similarly, I aim to sort of, really get us to understand, like, what are these force factors within fiscal policy and administration that actually contribute to and reinforce these inequalities, and so in a way that we can begin to kind of clarify what problems we face today and begin to imagine sort of ways forward and begin to think about, what ultimately, is this kind of structure compatible with the idea of actually sort of, facilitating and helping to diminish inequalities that capitalism produces, or is it actually reinforcing those? And I think that's one area where, beginning to look clearly at these policies and factors and understand as well, again, what lessons that African Americans experience as being kind of super exploited, to kind of borrow a term that Professor Burton Stella uses in her book, I think begins to sort of also alert us to the ways that this system actually generates inequality for many Americans and actually sort of results in exploitation that extends far beyond those experiences that African Americans are experiencing, but one that I think really can kind of put bring these into focus and hopefully begin from there to put these issues on the public's agenda. Because as I said at the outset, African-American neighborhoods continue to be over-assessed between 10 and 12% higher relative to value than white neighborhoods. African-Americans, homeowners are disproportionately victimized by these predatory tax sale laws. This past spring, there was a report in Crain's Chicago Business showing that Alden Global Capital, one of the largest hedge funds in the country, invested heavily in Chicago's and Cook County's tax sale, and almost all of the liens that they on properties they were buying were in black and brown neighborhoods. I mean, this again is something that is a quietly devastating communities, driving them down, all the while sort of continuing to funnel wealth upward in this country. And we got to sort of look at what those engines are if we're ever going to be able to hope to sort of dismantle them.
Thank you both so much. Let's give it up for our authors. Charisse Burton Stelly, author of Black Scare, Red Scare, and Andrew Carl, The Black Tax.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.